You're listening to the Labor Radio Podcast, weekly produced by the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org. I'm Chris Garlock. On today's show, Labor Express Radio celebrates 30 years on the air.
We started on WLUW originally at Loyola, but were booted from there when they basically booted all the community programming from the station.
The Resolved Labor Podcast highlights past leaders of the workers' rights movement.
I think she said, "I never took nothing from y'all. All I ever got from this place was my free lunch." And Hardy goes, "Wait a minute. What did you say about a free lunch?"
Kazim Nikah talks about workers in Iran on the Labor Start podcast.
Industrial actions for better pay, better working conditions are like this. But in reality, they are political. They are against the government because they are every day, they are confronting the regime's forces.
Succession creator and showrunner Jesse Armstrong tells the On Writing podcast about how he staffed and ran his writer's room.
I think people who haven't been in rooms, it can be an awful place when it's not working well and a sort of graveyard of hopes and dreams. But when they do, when it does work, I find it just a great experience. If I could do...
And from the Workers Rock podcast, an upstate New York dairy farmer who emigrated from Mexico talks about the Farm Laborers Fair Practice Act.
During the time over here, you got to work with heavy boots. You're always walking. The weather really gets to you. And when it's winter, then you have to wear a lot of clothing to keep you warm.
That's all ahead on this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Here's the show.
You're listening to WLPN 105.5 FM Chicago, and you're listening to Labor Express Radio, Chicago's longest-running labor news and current affairs radio program, news for working people by working people. I'm your host, Jerry Mead Lucero, and this is the Sunday, March 3rd, 2024 edition of Labor Express. And this is a special edition for us because it is a live in-studio program where we're having some of the people that have been on our program the most over the 20 years that I've been hosting the program. So a little history here. Labor Express originally launched back in 1993. So technically it's been on for 30 years, as we've just found out, as it was September of 1993. But I started in February of 2004. So it's my 20th anniversary here as the host producer of the program. We have Wayne Heimbach with us, who was the original host for the first 10 years of Labor Express Radio. And we're in the wonderful studios of WLPN, which I want to say real quick, too, has been a wonderful home for us. We started on WLUW originally at Loyola, but were booted from there when they basically booted all the community programming from the station. And thank God WLPN launched right at the same time as that purge happened. And we came here, which has been a wonderful home for us. WLPN has been incredibly supportive. So we're really excited to be on this station now for 2014, I think, is that when we first started it here at W? Yeah, 60, okay. So do you want to introduce yourself, Wayne, first?
Wayne Heimbach for Labor Express. It's been 20 years since I've been able to say that. And thank you very much, Jerry, for inviting me to your anniversary program.
Richard, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. And I'll just echo that. Congratulations to Labor Express. And, you know, this is happy birthday, I should say, 30 years.
I wish I was 20 still. That would be nice.
I'm Richard Berg. I'm the charter school coordinator of the Chicago Teachers Union. So I've been working for the Chicago Teachers Union for a number of years and in the labor movement for many decades, I guess.
I got to tell this story. So my dad is a former Chicago police officer, right? But he has had a big consciousness change over the years, right? So he's very, very class conscious, always been that way away, but he's also very anti-police now. And he got the FOP newsletter at home, and he's like, oh my God, they got all these people running in, you know, positions for alderman. The Chicago police are going to take over this city, and he was really upset and everything. I said, I wouldn't be so quick to say that. And I showed him the list of all the CTU candidates, you know, that were being endorsed and so on. I compared those after this was over. The FOP candidates almost to a man lost. I think there was like two out of their list that actually got anywhere, and the CTU candidates practically swept. It's a real sign to me of the power the CTU has developed politically in this city. But tell me what you think are the highlights you'd say for the last year for the CTU.
And thanks for the question. Clearly, our brother Brandon Johnson being on the fifth floor in the mayor's office is a big deal. But I do want to talk about Instituto del Progreso Latino, which is where you used to work as well. We just came off a 5-day strike there. And this is the first charter school employer in the United States that's been struck twice now, both times by the CTU, of course. And it's a good example. It's not huge like the United Auto Workers strike, but this is a union. The first strike was led by men, and there was a certain, you know, some of the women felt a certain way about how they handled things at that time. But this second strike was led by women. And we're approaching International Women's Day, which will be March 8th. Mm-hmm. And so I want to hold up these sisters who you know, really didn't have a background in the movement. They had a background being teachers, being educators. They cared and loved their students. And because of that, they were willing to do extraordinary things. The Instituto had started shifting money, public money that they get from Chicago public schools. They would use rent and management fees and things like that to take money out of the classrooms and put it into other parts of their organization. And so the education levels, you know, the resources to teach students was going down. And this strike made a difference. We got a guaranteed in our contract, a librarian, a nurse in the schools, a behavioral interventionist. So the education of the students at Instituto will be dramatically changed because all the workers, you know, all of them stood together and struck for 5 days and made a difference. So I want to uphold them before I get and for, you know, the listeners out there, you're just like them. I mean, we're not all Brandon Johnson, you know. Maybe some of you are, but I'm not. But we're all have jobs like that, and the power of Brandon Johnson or anything else comes from working people standing together.
Mm-hmm. Hello, troublemakers. Does this sound familiar? If this discussion could in any way lead to my being disciplined or terminated or affect my personal work condition, I respectfully request that my union representative, officer, or steward be present at this meeting. Without union representation, I choose not to answer questions. This, listeners, are some form of your Weingarten rights. Every person that is protected under a union contract has these rights. Hirsch Harris Weingarten was a poor immigrant from what is now known as Austria-Hungary. In 1901, he and his son Joseph opened a grocery store in downtown Houston. Their motto was better food for less. By 1967, there was a chain of stores around Texas, Arkansas, and Louisiana. By 1972, there were about 100 stores throughout the South. Some of these stores included what was called lobby food operations. At the lobby food operations, you could eat indoors. It was a little bit more fancy. And then there was the takeout. The takeout ones was just exactly what it sounds like. It was just the carry out, and it was carry out only. But that's not who we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about the hero of our story, Laura Collins. In 1961, Laura Collins was hired as a salesperson at store number 2. This location was carry out only. Follow me here, carry out only. She worked there for 9 years. In 1970, Laura transferred to store number 98. This location was the fancier lobby style. The salespeople there were represented by Retail Clerks Union. Loss prevention specialists also worked at Weingarten's. they worked undercover. They were so deep undercover that management sometimes didn't even know who they were. They were hired to apprehend people suspected of theft. This included employees. In 1972, Laura Collins decided to take some food home. A coworker reported that she saw Laura taking money out of the cash register. The loss prevention specialist assigned was Don Hardy. He staked the place out for a couple of days and reported no findings. After this, it was reported that someone saw Laura take a large box of chicken, which cost $2.98, but they claimed that Laura only put $1 in the cash register. Laura was called to the manager's office. When they got there, Hardy and the manager started in with the questions. Laura, being that union person, asked for her rep, as she should. Let's put a pin in that. If you are protected under a union contract, never speak to management without a union rep. That is my pro tip. But moving on, they were like, that'll be a no, dog. We're just going to keep going with these questions. Laura explained that she was just buying some chicken to take home to her family that night. But because she, you know, but because there were no more small boxes, which would have been the $1 box, she had to use the large box, which would have been $2.98, to hold her order. So Hardy went out and verified with the other employees at the store that they were, in fact, out of small boxes. Then the coworker who reported this admitted that they didn't really know how many pieces Laura had in her box. Hardy came back and was like, sorry, Laura, that's our bad. Looks like this investigation is over. A lot of places that you'll read on the internet, they'll say that she was crying. I think she said, I never took nothing from y'all. All I ever got from this place was my free lunch. And Hardy goes, wait a minute, what did you say about a free lunch? And so she was like, yeah, my free lunch. That's all I ever took from this place. Everything else I pay for. And he was like, sit down. Let's talk some more about this free lunch you've been getting. And so she's like, well, can I get my union rep if we're going to open up another investigation on something else? And again, she was denied union representation. Laura explained that one of the perks at working at the store was that employees were entitled to a free lunch. Hardy called headquarters to verify this. They explained that at the takeout stores, follow along here, at the takeout stores where Laura used to work, yes, they were entitled to a free lunch. However, at the sit-down lobby stores, those employees were not entitled to a free lunch. So Hardy did some mental math, and he presented Laura with this bill for $160. He said, girl, I called headquarters. Ain't no free lunch. Hand me over $160 for all those lunches that you've eaten since you've worked here. Laura refused to sign it. Hardy decided to do a little bit more digging. Turns out pretty much all the employees at store number 98 were getting free lunches because nobody had ever told them that they couldn't. And this included the managers. Rather than admit their mistake and face their embarrassment, Hardy stopped asking the questions, and the manager asked Collins, hey, don't worry about all this. We're just going to keep this investigation between us. Laura did not. She went straight to her steward, as she should have. Her union filed an unfair labor practice. The National Labor Relations Board found in favor of Laura Collins. They gave Weingarten a cease and desist order. However, Weingarten, they appealed in the 5th District Court. Weingarten prevailed, and they were not obligated to enforce the cease and desist order that came from the National Labor Relations Board. The National Labor Relations Board appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in 1975, the courts established what's known as Weingarten writes. Why it's not called Collins Writes, I'll never know.
Hello, this is Eric Lee, and this week on the Labor Start podcast, we're interviewing Kazem Nikka. Kazem is the international director, maybe we'll fix that too, of Free Them Now, an organization that speaks out on behalf of Iranian working people. Welcome to the show, Kazem.
Thank you very much.
So, Kazem, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about what's happening in Iran today. Let's start with, what is the situation of working people right now in Iran?
Yeah, briefly, if I want to put it, you know the situation, the economy in Iran is very stagnating, collapsing, bankrupting. And because of the Iranian regime's isolation in the globally, so they are very, the economy is somehow is getting apart and not working. Right. So they are using, basically relying on smuggling, import, export, mostly are by illegal methods and not paying the workers salaries. And so you know the situation from this aspect. So this puts a much pressure on the workers. Some places are very like slavery-like conditions. And but the workers are struggling very actively, very massively. So we have a very active, turbulent worker movement in Iran. Workers, retirees, nurses, teachers, every day we have at least 10 strikes or gatherings or protests in different places. And so I don't think anywhere in the world is so broad protests in a country. The demands of the workers is mainly for better pay, better working conditions, an end to the securitizing the protests and against the authorities and against the corruption and for not against the not paid salaries. These are the main demands of the workers. And these days we are seeing nurses are, for example, have started gatherings and strikes in Shiraz and different places in Iran. Oil workers are very active, formal oil workers and contract oil workers, third pillar oil workers. All is very turbulent in the oil industry in Iran, which is very important, you know. So I can say is that everywhere is something is happening. When retirees, pensioners have every day gatherings in many cities, sometimes 20 cities in Iran. They affect the whole society because they are in contact with people, for all people, different sections of the society. This is briefly what I can say.
What are the prospects of real change?
I'm very optimistic, Eric. I'm very optimistic about the situation because these protests in their straight demands are for like industrial actions, for better pay, better working conditions and like this. But in reality, they are political. They are against the government because they are every day they are confronting the regime's forces. So in situation in Iran, is very people are very optimistic, very aggressive against the regime. For example, yesterday in Qom, this is center of religious regime, Mullah was taking picture of a woman and the whole people in the hospital attacked him and take his camera and took off the pictures. I mean,
why was he taking pictures of a woman?
Because she hadn't hijab on her.
She wasn't wearing hijab. Okay.
Yeah. Wow. So, and the hijab has gone despite the regime's very pressure on the women, but they don't listen, they don't obey. And so hijab in reality has gone.
Kazım, I'm not going to try to say your last name again, but thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We'll talk soon.
You're listening to On Writing, a podcast from the Writers Guild of America East. In each episode, you'll hear from the union members who create the film, TV series, podcasts, and news stories that define our culture. We'll discuss everything from inspirations and creative process to what it takes to build a successful career in media and entertainment. I'm your host, Taffy Brodesser-Ackner, and I'm thrilled to talk with Jesse Armstrong, the creator and showrunner of the acclaimed HBO series Succession. In this episode of On Writing, we discuss how the uncertainty of who would win the finale shaped Succession's writing, navigating writers' rooms as a new showrunner, and our existential crises following our show's ending. Hello, Jesse Armstrong. Welcome to the Writers Guild. First of all, these amazing offices at the Writers Guild East, and also to On Writing, the Writers Guild podcast. We are so happy to have you. There is so much to talk about. You wrote a show. It's called Succession. I just had the terrible luck of having the flu. I want to talk more broadly about endings, first of the show and of what this means now and what this meant to you. But I would like to talk first about the writing of the show.
Right.
Did you know when you started it how it was going to end? It feels like if you watch it now, I'll answer this for you. I'm sorry, I'll answer this for you. If you watch it now, it feels like it is so clear what you were planning.
Really? That's fascinating. Have you got any more on that?
No.
Good. Well, I didn't. I very much didn't. I guess what's true is I knew what the tonal ending was, and that was, and therefore, I think if you're writing a certain kind of mystery show or maybe a genre show of a certain kind or a crime or a sci-fi, then you need to know the answer to what, you know, if there is a mystery, you need to know very practically what the answer is, right?
Right.
Otherwise, you run the risk of disappointing the audience with making it into a Shaggy Dog story. I don't think there was any such danger in ours because I knew that tonally, and hopefully, or that would be my guess about what you're responding to, that tonally the ending is as of a piece with the beginning. And in a way, that's not so hard because, say, another person had won and become the CEO. Hopefully, if the plot elements had aligned to make that feel really satisfactory in a logical sense, it would have been tonally right because the end of the show is not a triumphant, this person is going to save the company and save media or America or newspapers. That's not the tone, right? And so I knew that wasn't going to be the tone. And therefore, the precise nature of the plot ending was not so important to know.
The
actual tone of it? Because we're doing spoilers.
Because the tone is the tone. And and I want to talk about the tone and the voice of the show. And in specific, later, I would like to ask about how a group of people agreed on that tone. Because I don't have the experience of writing in a room, and I can't believe how sort of everyone agreed and pushed this tone all the way through. Its specificity, its sharpness. But it seems to me that from the beginning there is this plot question: who is going to succeed Logan? Like that is actually the sort of big question of the pilot, right?
Yeah.
If you go back to watch the pilot, the ball I feel like you hid was it was never going to be one of these children. Was that?
I think that's true. I don't know what I would have said if I'd been put on a polygraph when we were making the pilot, which was a long time ago. And, you know, you're so consumed or your present engaged part of your mind is so consumed with, like, the next scene, getting the pilot picked up, what we'd do if we did a first season, the kind of deeper creative machinations of how this might work have gone into abeyance a bit. I guess I'm the one thinking about the show the most in between seasons and probably the most. So a lot of times the room acts as a proving ground for things that you thought about on your own, and then you come into this incredibly engaged, bright group of people and say, what about this? I've been thinking this. And that's a great place to find out if it rings true when you say it to a smart group of people who know the show inside out, and whether they come up with a twist on it or reject it and say, you know, that doesn't feel, you know, why do you want to do that? And you can, it's a good way of interrogating yourself about your impulses and whether they're kind of good and good for the show impulses or not.
Interesting.
I think people who haven't been in rooms, obviously they're more common, and lots of people, hopefully WGA members, will experience it. But it is a great, it can be an awful place when it's not working well, in a sort of graveyard of hopes and dreams, right, and sort of for everyone, right, you know, and you can have, they can just not work. But when they do, when it does work, I find it just a great experience. If I could keep on doing the room without doing a show, I might be quite tempted to do that.
Welcome to Workers Rock, a podcast that explores this truth, that we have the power to change the culture of employment across the globe. I'm Emmeret Miller, the host of Workers Rock. Workers Rock is part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network.
We're here with Fernando, who is a dairy worker in upstate New York. We're talking about the fight for equity in the workplace when it comes to farm workers. We also have Carlos Aguirre as a Spanish interpreter. How are you, Fernando?
Bien, muy bien.
Well, doing well.
Okay, all right. Thank you for joining Workers Rock today. So we're going to talk about your trade, what you do. How long have you been a dairy worker in upstate New York?
Prácticamente ya 20 años trabajando en lo que es la industria de las lecherías.
Well, practically now it has been 20 years working in the dairy industry.
Aquí en Nueva York.
Right here in New York.
Where did you move from? What's your home country?
De México, del estado de Oaxaca.
I'm from Mexico, originally from the state of Oaxaca.
All right. So there have been changes to the working conditions for farm workers overall in New York State, especially since 2019. But what was it like for you when you first started on the farm compared to now?
Bueno, ha habido muchos cambios alrededor de estos 20 años. Al principio, cuando yo inicié.
Well, there have been a lot of changes in the last 20 years compared to at the beginning when I started.
Las condiciones de trabajo ha cambiado. No son las adecuadas, pero sí va mejorando.
The working conditions have changed. They're not the most adequate, but they are getting better.
Y todo tiene que ver porque, bueno, las leyes han cambiado ahorita, en los últimos 4 años.
That also has to do with the laws changing in the last 4 years.
Aunque no se compara la agricultura con otras industrias.
Although you can't compare agriculture with other industries.
Why not?
Bueno, porque el límite de horas que uno trabaja en la agricultura es pesado, son 12 horas al día.
Well, because of the limit in hours that you work in farming, I mean, it's a 12-hour days.
Wow.
También el salario es bajo, es el más bajo que uno gana.
There's also a low salary. It's the lowest we earn.
Do any of your colleagues live on premises? Where do your colleagues live?
Sí, en la agricultura o en las lecherías, todos los trabajadores viven en las casas que son proveídas por el rancho. Es como muy cerca del rancho.
Yes. In agriculture and dairy, the employees, the workers, they live on the houses provided by the rancher. They are all very close to the location of the ranch itself.
Now, tell me about 12-hour day is a long time, you know. What is it like for you physically to go through this work schedule?
Bueno, es muy difícil y es muy pesado el horario por el clima, porque uno camina todo el día con botas pesadas. En el frío tiene uno que usar ropa muy pesada también y gruesa.
Well, it's very difficult because, I mean, during the time over here, you gotta work with heavy boots. You always walking. The weather really gets to you, and when it's winter, then you have to wear a lot of clothing to keep you warm.
So, what happens if you want to take a day off to rest? If you want to take a day off, do you get paid for it?
Bueno, normalmente tenemos un día libre a la semana. Si te tomas otro día extra, no se te paga.
Well, we normally get one day off a week. If you take another one, you don't get paid.
Well, thank you so much, Fernando. Thank you so much, Carlos, for taking your time tonight.
Gracias por el interés en querer apoyar y difundir la voz de nosotros como trabajadores.
Well, thank you for being able to help us and give us a voice to us, the workers, in trying to help us out.
Oh, most definitely. All right. Have a good night.
Hey, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Just a small sample of the amazing programs aired over the last week on more than 200 labor radio and podcast shows. They're all part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, shows that focus on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org. You can also find them. Use the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. The Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, edited this week by Patrick Dixon. I produce the show, and our social media guru, as always, is Mr. Harold Phillips. For the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio podcast show. We'll see you next week.